respond to Kim's paper if he has arrived, but I don't see him here. So unfortunately, we won't be able to have a response, and that will give you more time for questions and answers.
Well, 20 responses.
Okay. Kim has just handed me a bio for the Sunstone presentation, so I'm going to share that with you. But I want to preface what I say by giving my gratitude to Kim for agreeing to come and present this paper. Kim is a longtime friend, and we've crossed paths in numerous circumstances, and I have a great deal of respect for Kim's contribution in many different areas. Kim is a dedicated teacher. He spends an extraordinary amount of time in preparation and in thought and in presenting ideas that are provocative, that cause people to want to search more into the gospel. He's also made great contributions in music. He has always worked hard to make sure that music is an integral part of the LDS worship process. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. That is something that is at the core of my sense of worship within the church. Kim McCall, who has degrees in philosophy and computer science from Stanford University, is delighted to be frequent contributor to Sunstone Symposia. He has presented papers on topics as diverse as a snake on a pole, symbolic understanding of the atonement, or how I learned to stop worrying and love Nephi, and five arguments for the elimination of the worthiness interview. Kim, who once had a mind and life of his own, has been progressively possessed by the body snatchers. He now teaches Sunday school, directs his stake youth choir, tutors once or twice a week, actually does some home teaching, "Behold, I will show unto you a God of miracles," and teaches early morning seminary. He insists that his occasional visits to the stake genealogy library are only to help with their computer system. But one begins to wonder.
Thanks a lot, Richard. I was afraid I was going to get a really nice introduction, and it would tell you how hard I work and how I think about things and make great presentations, and that always intimidates me. And Todd Compton suggested that I give a really, really lousy talk, and that people's expectations would be lower for the next few years, and I could sleep, you know, before I present things. But we'll see whether I will fulfill his recommendation. There's the topic that I'm going to talk about today. I don't know if it's provocative or not. I actually expect that it isn't, but there are enough hooks here that I hope people will be interested, and I hope that you in particular will contribute to the discussion in the final 15 minutes about how I can extend these ideas and how we all can extend these ideas and where we're going in some sense. Let me give this introduction and then tell you why I think it's important. At last year's Salt Lake Symposium, Eugene England seemed to say that there was a Mormon Studies Center at Utah Valley State College in which faculty from across the curriculum were beginning to study the intersection of their particular disciplines with LDS experience, history, and thought, whatever. I went to him and talked to him in the hall afterwards and said, "This sounds really great." And he encouraged me to consider joining the UVSC faculty to pursue research in Mormonism and computers. I assumed he was joking, but no such luck. Incapable of permanently or completely ignoring any of Gene's encouragements throughout my life, I eventually got intrigued. To toss out the thing that strikes me as interesting about this, if you had to name the top four inventions of all time, somebody who knows more than I do should answer this question. But you know, to me, it's fire, irrigation wheel, and the movable type, the printing press. And the one that I love, of course, is the printing press. And when Gutenberg invented that thing, it turned a great deal of the intellectual and spiritual world upside down, right? Suddenly, people were able to get a lot more information than they had before. They began to ask questions and think about things that they never asked or thought about before. And it was it rocked something near the foundations of the Catholic Church. And I sense, although this is open to debate, that we're in the middle of a mini Gutenberg revolution, that the internet is providing accessibility of information, of publishing, of information, of communication, of connection across the world, of the availability of ideas that echoes in a boomlet way the Gutenberg revolution, and that institutions which have based their legitimacy on being the only source of knowledge or the able to control paths of information and things are going to have to adapt, are going to be shaken to a certain extent. And I want to, among other things, there's a lot to say about computers and the church that, you know, once I started thinking about it, I said, wow, there's really a lot of stuff here. And I started getting excited about the idea of going to UVSC and undertaking some kind of research in this area. Alas, Gene's description of this program was at best premature. There's a sort of nascent, embryonic effort to envision what a Mormon Studies program would be, and they have occasional lecturers come and talk about things in the interface between Mormonism and various disciplines, but there's no faculty positions that are doing anything about this sort of thing yet, and I was I won't be doing that. I won't be going to UVSC for a couple of years probably for anything like that, if ever. But it did get me thinking, and at the time I wanted to give this talk as a way of beginning to lay out what I would work on for the next couple of years. But in my current job, I've managed to negotiate at least three or four months out of the year that I won't be working, and so I will be able to study things that I'm interested in, and I want to do some of this. And I hope other people will do it. It might be the sort of thing that we can do collaboratively, since there's so much of that going on. Okay. So it occurred to me this could actually be a fascinating, important, and even respectable thing to study. The way a relatively traditional, hierarchical, centrally defined institution with strong values and mores responds to and is influenced, affected, molded by the new modes of publishing and community and the new attitudes and expectations they will bring and train. I see that it's hard to know when you're in the middle of a cultural shift. We thought we were in the 60s, and it's not clear that a lot of that survived, except in a few of our hearts. But the way that the way that people look at information in themselves, I think, is going to be really influenced by the modes of communication that are coming and that are upon us. Okay. As I said, my primary goal in writing this presentation was to lay out a map of what might be worth studying in the intersection of LDS faith and practice, faith, practice, and experience, on the one hand, and the advent of ubiquitous information processing, publishing, and communication that is upon us, as well as having hopefully sparked your interest to solicit your input about more areas or issues worth exploring. That's why I've handed out this thing. I want you to sense that in this scattershot thing there's a bit of organization, but I also want you to, you know, scribble down notes about more issues or areas worth exploring that haven't occurred to me that I don't mention here. Okay. Do you all know what happened on March 15th in terms of local area websites, local ward and stake websites? The presiding bishopric sent out a letter to all area representatives, regional representatives, stake presidents, ward bishops, district leaders, whatever they're called these days, district presidents, and talking about the need for the church to present a somewhat unified voice, the existence of correlated, was actually one of the words, websites at church headquarters, and the possibility that people could do things that would get the church in some kind of trouble. And then in the final, it sort of encouraged people to take web citizenship seriously, but the final line was in capital letters. It said, disable... You know, make sure that all of your local unit websites are disabled, period. And within 3 weeks, 6,000 websites disappeared from the web around the world, from local wards and stakes.
I have actually been in communication with a fellow who advises the First Presidency and the Forum of the Twelve on how to think about the Internet. And I actually know a fair amount about the way that they're thinking about these things. And toward the end, at the very end, maybe I'll talk about that a little bit. But for the moment, before I get riled up, it's data. Okay, it's... I wrote here, I hope it's clear that some of this is actually not too boring. Move as sudden and, in my mind, at least drastic as the disabling of every local unit website in the entire church must be a response to powerful forces and concerns. Trying to understand and characterize these should be fascinating, exciting, and possibly even fruitful. Let me just give a little bit more of my understanding of the background of why of what's going on here. The last 4 months around Silicon Valley have been really fascinating. Okay, there's been a bit of a course correction in our enthusiasm about about the future and the Internet, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But when I wrote this stuff, I actually wrote most of this paper a few months ago, which is very unusual for me. And I would have said then, and I still think it's more or less true, that the intellectual, cultural, and economic world is in rapid transition, if not revolution. The sources of knowledge, our understanding of human expression, our capacity for expression, our opportunities for connection, community, communication, are changing really rapidly. I mean, if you just think, I mean, how many of you are connected to the Internet and surf the web, and when you have a question, you type something into your computer, you go to Google and you find out. Okay, it's extraordinary, thank you. It's extraordinary how fast you can find out how much. Whether it's reliable or not is another question. But, you know, it's astonishing to me how rapidly you can, you know, without going to a library, without having a huge library of your own, you've got half the library in the world available to you on your PC. So the sense that information is really easily available and that you find out stuff from a million different places is growing. Okay, and I think this is going to actually make a difference in the mindset of our time. Okay, the way that we look, okay, our notions of and respect for authority. Okay, it used to be that there were, you know, a few really knowledgeable people who dispensed authority, dispensed knowledge, and were called authorities. And the sense that you can find out a lot of more stuff from a lot more people, I think it's going to change the way people think. I think that it's fascinating to me, being nearly 50 years old, to watch the young people's attitudes about Napster. Okay, this is a system that allows you, that until a couple of weeks ago, allowed you to get any music you wanted for free. You download it to your computer, and you could find, you know, practically anything in the world musical out there, download it to your computer, and people felt like they were entitled to this. Okay, people under 30 think that this is the way the world is supposed to work. Okay, that if there's stuff out there, nobody owns it. Okay, and I can, you know, they're so used to things being free and information being free that the whole idea of copyrights and the whole idea of possessing information and meeting it out in little, what did Eliot say, coffee spoons, is not appropriate. You know, it doesn't fit with their way of thinking. So there's a sense not only of decreased reliance on authority, but of entitlement to information. Certainly, you know, if I type something in there about the book of Hebrews, okay, because I'm doing research on Hebrews, I get a huge number of sources of information, a divergence of views, and our awareness of the diversity of well-informed opinion is going to have to grow. Okay, everybody's sense that, you know, even if that person's not Mormon, they've actually read these things and they've thought about it hard, and our sense of, I think, of respect for diverse views can grow. And fastly, finally, one other aspect of this, then I'm going to talk about Mormons a little more, is the ease of connecting with like-minded fellow travelers, okay, that you can find people who think like you out there a lot more easily. Your circle of potential acquaintances used to be much smaller, and now your circle of potential, quote, acquaintances, unquote, you know, is enormous, and your ability to collect a community of affinity, I would call it, is greatly enhanced. And so, you know, we have MoFemNet, the Mormon Feminist Network, and these people all found each other, and now they can talk to each other and reinforce each other's point of view and feel a sense of legitimacy that you can't feel when you're real isolated. And while it's true of Mormon feminists, it's also true of gunslinging isolationist survivalists. Okay? And so it's not necessarily a good thing in my view that everybody, you know, they get their little their groups of reinforcing opinions, and you get a certain kind of balkanization, a certain kind of clustering of people who now only listen to more people who think like they do, or listen to those people most of the time and feel stronger in their views. And, you know, I'm happy with that when it's certain Mormon lists that I get my strokes from, but there's also the survivalists. So, okay. So now, suppose we're doing research on this. How will each of these affect our experience of our hierarchical, protocol-bound, information-controlling church? Will the institutional church feel itself threatened by the chaotic information environment? and how will it adapt is my word here, my hopeful word. Respond might have been a more appropriate word. And it, you know, I asked these questions a few weeks ago, and we're getting one kind of response now, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But the attempt to understand what the forces are that allow the church to continue in the way it's used to continuing, and whether those are being threatened, in fact, is really worth understanding. Okay. Another aspect of the Gutenberg Revolution is, you know, is just this vast. I'm going on to the second thing on your piece of paper there, if you're interested in whether this is coherent. It's worth studying in terms of the missions and values of the church, the content and phenomena that the internet enabled. Top on my list is the top on a lot of people's list in the church is pornography. Okay, the ability of people to do things that had social sanctions before and were really hard to do that are out of bounds is greatly increased. And I know there is tremendous concern about this among church leaders. And you know, there's a lack of any concept of what to do about it, of course. But to try to understand how people are being influenced by that and actually study it. We have a lot of stereotypes about what pornography is and what its effect is on people, and sometimes those are valid and sometimes they aren't valid. And it'd be interesting to try to understand what's going on and how an institution with real values that are legitimately and validly violated by pornography can, in fact, respond to it in a healthy way. Anybody who's been out there and looked up Mormon stuff knows there's as much anti-Mormon literature and diatribe out there as there is faith-promoting stuff. I love the term. I got it from Nadine, but apparently she got it from Carol Lynn. There's faith-promoting and faith-demoting information out there, and how we respond to that and how members of the church respond to that. I've had people come to me and say, you know, I went out there on the net, and the story just isn't the way I was taught it. What do you do with that, Tim? And, you know, it is a real issue, okay, for people who've been raised in one way to suddenly confront immense amounts of information. I mean, we have experts in how do you teach people the truth about history in a way that respects their intelligence and prepares them for something like the real truth. And so something like the real truth is going to become more and more available. And the church is going to have to find ways of adapting to that, or, you know, there will be a certain weeding out process, as some people might think of it. Okay, the breadth and variety of perspectives, the easy access to scientific and humanistic understandings of the world. Okay, I mentioned already accidental discovery. Just to mention a few other things that are sort of not on the intellectual end, there's a lot of matchmaking and dating services out there. And one of the things the church is interested in is pairing people up. And that's something that happens on the internet in healthy and unhealthy ways. And certainly, I guess there are like four or five Mormon singles organizations on the web that'll, for a fee, pair you up with people or something like that. Okay. But the to somebody new to this stuff, and even to me, it feels like a vast, undisciplined, out-of-control template of information. Anyway, if you can think of other things, this focus was on the Internet for just a moment here. The focus of this section was the content phenomena of the Internet, the behaviors it encourages, the content that's out there, and its effect on values and mission of the church. If you have other aspects of that what I've said have triggered, write them down and we'll talk about them, okay? The next thing I wanted to study, it strikes me that a lot of the stuff that ought to be happening right now is anthropological, okay? To see how regular members of the church are relating to this whole new source of information, this whole new way of getting information and operating in the world, okay? Now, if we're different from other people, general computer use, how much time do we spend using our computers? And what are we doing with it? General Internet use, how much time we spend, what are we doing? Do we participate in online forums? Do we find friends that way? What sorts of things are people in fact doing? It's time to get sort of a baseline and a sense of whether we are like other people in the world or whether there's anything distinguishing about us in the way that we're using these facilities. You know, I'm sure there's some topics that we're studying more than others. What's the third most popular thing? You know what the first most popular thing is to do on the Internet. The third most popular thing is genealogy, strikingly enough. There are so many websites and they have so much traffic, and that's what people are spending their time, not Mormons. I mean, certainly Mormons, but all kinds of people. The church has noticed. They're getting tremendous publicity for the work we have done in the Ellis Island Project and in the Freeman Bank Project, really positive and somewhat deservedly so, publicity for our contributions in that area. So let's see. And to me, most interesting, establish a baseline for what are our ideas about the reliability and value of different sources of information and see how those change over time. How, if at all, are they changing? Compare these to our non-Mormon peers. Okay. Study the use of official and unofficial church-related sites. How much do people study them? What do they use them for? I actually go to the church website to find scriptures these days because there's a really decent concordance. You can type in, submissive and something like that. and you find that verse in Mosiah that I railed against a couple of years ago. Okay, but you can find, that's just a recent occurrence. I almost found one I was looking for recently on another subject. Okay, but there are all the lesson manuals are out there. Okay, so I'm a seminary teacher. I can find the seminary teacher lesson manual out there and copy things down, and we use it for that. Reading and borrowing general conference talks has suddenly got a whole lot easier. The church magazine. So these are the official ones. Unofficial ones, imagine doing the same, making the same sorts of facilities available for other people. Okay, so that, one of my dreams is that I put, and I've actually done a tiny bit of this, some of Sheldon Greaves' sacrament meeting talks on the web. And then people start downloading and they say, man, that's a good talk. I could give a talk like that. And the quality of sacrament meeting talks around the church goes up. Okay, and the sorts of things that count as legitimate spiritual discourse gets expanded and enhanced. And anyway, that's in my suggestions part later, but I thought you were all going to get bored if I didn't say something interesting. Okay, so that's behaviors of individual members. The next one that I want to study is attitudes of individual members and their reactions to this stuff. I'm an enthusiast. I'm curious. I love to explore pretty much. But I imagine a lot of people being bewildered, a lot of people being there's so much stuff out there, my reaction to it is going to be, the reaction of a lot of people in confusing worlds is retrenchment and retreat, okay, to go back to what you know and get back to the iron rod and all that kind of stuff. And so try to gauge how people are responding to this by doing ethnographic studies, by doing surveys, by finding out what's really happening. I think over time that will be a fascinating thing to know. Okay. So one of the things that I wanted to say, which Lee Paulson wanted to make sure I was going to say, the discovery of like-minded friends and in an uncensored environment may lead to greater practice and eventually confidence in feeling and expressing non-standard or independent perspectives and ideas. It's one of the things that he says has helped him stay connected with the church. Okay, if I can write to David Bailey when I have, you know, when people in my ward are saying silly things about evolution, okay, and when I say something in my Sunday school class about it, and somebody says, "Where did you get those ideas?" and I can refer them to a collection of articles that I have because Iring L exists. Okay, I'm using code words here, I'm afraid. It helps people stay involved and stay connected to know that they're not the only people who don't think that you're identifying with ants or something when you think that God used natural means to bring us here. Okay, the point of that was that a couple of things. One is that we begin to more sufficiently. I've got to find a better word. We take care of ourselves by defining our religious experience in terms of people that we are comfortable with. We have to remember what Gene said about the church and the gospel in that regard. But it keeps us more in touch with the church. And but it also, what I wanted to say here, yes, discussion in the supportive, non-coercive cyberspace may lead people to expect the same in the real world. Okay, that if I can talk to David and other friends about topics like that and feel comfortable and feel legitimate, and then I go to Sunday school, at least there's a I may expect the same thing, which may lead me to act in a way that actually enriches the Sunday school class, or it may lead me to be devastated when I say something and, you know, this actually does happen sometimes. Now I'm a teacher, so I get it's easier, but it may create a dissonance too with your church experience, with your Sunday experience. And to study that stuff, because I think the sense, people's attitudes, how they change, is going to be really interesting to see. Okay. Dear to the heart of the church, and for good reasons, the social behavior and effects of computers on individuals, families, and groups. Okay. What happens out there? Do we actually, you know, one of the things that What's the number one use of the internet? It's not pornography. It's mail. It's email. Okay, and what is happening with email? Are we actually strengthening ties with families and with remote people? Is it actually contributing to some of what we want, which is that when our kids are away at school, we're more in touch with them. We're keeping track of their lives. When our siblings are in far flung areas, that, you know, what we used to get by being physically close, we now get by being digitally close or something like that. I think there is a fair amount of that. On the other hand, the computer sucks up time. It's an added distraction from family. It's an added distraction from church even. Recreation and games, taking work home, finding friends and ignoring old ones, all of these, we want to see whether these things are happening and what to do. One of the things that has struck me as a big thing in Silicon Valley, and as the world becomes more and more like it, jobs are cannibalistic around here. Okay, they eat you, your time, your interests. They want you a whole lot of hours. And whether that is happening and chronicling that is important to do. The increased demands of a sped-up society with less time for community and family. Something that is already starting to be documented by the people studying the use of computers, the increased gulf between generations. There's something IRC and IM, okay, internet messaging, or instant messaging and internet relay chat. Everybody under the age of 25 is constantly sending messages to each other over the internet, and they're just always in these conversations. And the older people don't even know what this is, okay, and the gap between the world experiences of the generations is actually getting larger and being made larger by this, as well as the games and the music that they play and listen to. Okay. and I said already about this, on the formation, so one of the social behaviors that can affect the church, the formation of distributed affinity groups as primary identification could detract from community and ward identification, or could strengthen the sense of worldwide church identifying with people with common beliefs around the world. It'll be interesting to see which of these play out, if they all play out. Behaviors of the institution, general and local, that's the next topic here. For a moment, let's imagine that there's initiatives that the church can take, and they have. Okay, they actually did create a website that has evolved over time and is not nearly as bad now as it was for a while. In terms of there's stuff out there that's sort of useful, in my opinion. So study the creation and evolution. Somebody needs to document the creation and the evolution over time of LDS.org. Which are they going to rename it now that we're not the LDS Church? Sorry, my little joke. What is getting done on church computers? Okay, genealogy. Okay, there's just, if you go to the Family History Center, and I have spent some time there helping with their computers, there is just an immense amount of energy going into writing programs and doing research and all that kind of stuff. Our computer is going to be at all useful in missionary work. Just for a minute about the church's self-defined mission, okay? There's all this redeeming the dead stuff, all the genealogy stuff. There's a tremendous application for computers there. How about in missionary work? I think they're concerned about the image of the church. One of the reasons that they brought down the websites is because they're very, very image conscious, and people were putting up all kinds of crazy things, or they had their websites where there was advertising on them that wasn't appropriate and things like that. My question about them, I think that our self-image and our theology are influenced by the way we tell our story. Okay, that the recent immense effort to make ourselves not feel weird to the world, okay, which is one of President Hinckley's big themes. You know, we're weird in the sense that we've got real values. You ought to love that, folks. But he, you know, otherwise we're just like you. You know, we're that sort of theme. To me, you know, I haven't heard anybody say in church, what was it? Oh God, I'm sorry. I should have written it down. But there are ways of talking about our theology. We certainly never say, as man is God once was, as God is man may become. And you don't hear. I heard that all the time when I was a kid. When I was in Mutual, this is a different story. You know, we used to say all the time, we quoted to each other every week, that the powers in them, however they are, agents unto themselves. And God would, oh God, I'm in front of you now, I can't think of it, but we're supposed to do many things of our own free will and bring to pass much righteousness and all that stuff. And, you know, I don't think my seminary kids know that scripture. But that's an aside. But the point is that as we say that we tell our story influences how we think about our story, okay, and how we define our theology. And our immense effort not to feel discordant to the world has caused us to forget how discordant we are in good ways, you know, what our notion of man and God is. And there are some things to say about that. I'll jump ahead. Doctrinally, now I'll say that I'll be organized for a moment. But as we try to use these new tools to get our message across, how will it influence our message? Okay, I think that's just beginning, and I can't predict it. Okay, but it's an important thing to watch. Okay. What are computers doing in the translation process in the church? I have a way of finding out, and I will. So those are the initiatives that the church takes in this new world. They're also the reactions. Okay. There was a Mormon distribution list, a Mormon mail email list. I don't know if it was LDS Gems or what it was. That was, you know, a lot of people were getting sort of interesting news from the church, interesting news about the church. And the church decided it was getting a little too interesting, and they bought the copyright and the name and everything from the people who were doing it, and it became very bland. Okay, that's one kind of reaction. Another, you all are aware that the Church Handbook of Instruction, which governs how leaders in the church will deal with us, was photocopied and put on the net. And the church, through their lawyers, sued the people who were doing this for copyright infringement, okay, as a way of suppressing the availability of the rules that govern the church in practice. So that's another reaction, is that you try to keep things from being known. And, of course, the suppression, at least temporarily, of local unit websites. Okay, that's the official church reaction, the behaviors of the institutional, general, and local church. Next topic, the emerging unofficial, unsponsored internet content and behavior. What sorts of websites and email lists exist now? Sheldon Greaves wrote about 3 years ago an article in Sunstone about all the Mormon email lists, and it was so interesting. But there are a ton of websites out there, too. And I know a few of them, www.firstward.ldsweb.org, lds-mormon.com, and mormons.org. Two of those are very orthodox, and two of them are not at all concerned with being orthodox. And, you go to a web search engine, and it doesn't care whether you're orthodox or not. It shows you interesting information. Okay, we need to enumerate and categorize them and track the evolution of these things. But more than that, I want to know how well they're known. Who knows about the websites? How well are they visited? How frequently are they patronized? And what effect are they having? Okay. Other faith-promoting and demoting uses of computation. You all know, are you aware of the concept of word prints? There's an alleged proof of the multiple authorship of the Book of Mormon, which is a couple of statistics professors at BYU fed the Book of Mormon into a computer, labeled every verse as to who supposedly wrote it, and apparently they claim by statistical means proved that those different sections were written by different people. Okay, so this is supposed to be faith-promoting use of computers. There was a fabulous review, a really, really excellent review of that research that appeared on Sunstone a couple years after the research was published. If anybody wants to wade through literature on statistics, it's worth reading. Anyway, I'm curious how well known that supposed proof is, and whether it's become a folk evidence of the Book of Mormon and other ways that the computers can be used for promoting or demoting faith. Okay. The next thing that I want to see, and this is sort of real scattershot, but it's sort of detailed there a little bit. If you can slice the church in a lot of different ways. You can think of it as in terms of demographic groups. So youth, women, rich and poor, educated and uneducated, single versus married, and just look at internet use, look at what benefits they get, look at how each of them is experiencing the internet and how it relates with their faith. Okay. You can look at programs of the church instead. You can look at genealogy, welfare, missionary work, education, seminaries and institutes, singles, programs, and see how they're all using the internet and going to be affected by it. You can look at doctrines. I wanted to make my point. Question whether the multiple sources of information and the information age, as it's, I think, more or less accurately being called, is going to affect any of these things. My favorite, of course, is our understanding of God and man. I'm going to put an idea out that Joseph Smith's understanding of the nature of humanity and our relationship to God was this incredibly positive, optimistic view. To me, while I believe that was an inspired view, I believe it was also enabled by the fact he was living in a very optimistic time in the run-up to the manifest destiny idea that human progress was unlimited, that we were going to conquer the wilderness, and that this concept of progress was in the air. And so Joseph was susceptible to believing things like that, and Brigham was susceptible to doing things like that. Okay, and the possibilities seemed endless. Even if life was hard, the idea that we were going forward, there was and that sort of was process biology, all those sorts of things that were alive as a result of that took a tremendous dive as a result of World War II and the I'm wanting to say apocalypse, and I know that's not the right word. It's even Holocaust. That the sense that man was that human beings were really good got a real shock in the aftermath of World War II, and theology reflects that, and the Karl Barth and all these neo-Orthodox people bring us back to the concept of original sin and human weakness, and our church has followed, right? You get all this neo-Orthodox stuff the last couple decades as the sense of humanity's failure to live up to our supposed divine potential is really clear. And my sense 3 months ago was that this is changing again, okay? That there's something about new frontiers now. There's something about human potential as we've got the genome and as we extend our ability to communicate everywhere and we're feeling like we're sort of strong again and like we've got a lot of potential. And you know, as people in certain parts of the world were inventing the future. I mean, that's what we said we were doing at the Palo Alto Research Center. We knew it and we were inventing the future. And there's this whole sense of optimism about our possibilities that again took a bit of a shock in the last 3 months, but we'll rise again. No, there were good and bad aspects to that, right? I guess the quick superficiality of what it was that a lot of people were getting out of it was a real problem for spirituality. But for me, it feels to me like it's re-enabling the possibility of envisioning humans as really positive, really in really hopeful ways, and that we might get back to believing theology is really possible. Okay, that the drift toward a negative view of humanity can be actually interrupted a little bit by the new mentality that that gets carried away in a whole bunch of ways. But so we may be entering an age of optimism similar to the one in which the church was founded. We can have more pride in the value of human accomplishments. Pride. Which brings up what time is it?
55?
Oh no. Okay. here's a tiny silly speculation that the .com demise might make the fall of the Nephites ring more true. That our view of Joseph Smith is going to be influenced by our access to a whole lot of uncorrelated material about him. Okay. Traditional family values may be assailed by greater exposure to alternative lifestyles. I'm sorry that we're out of time. I have a whole bunch of possible initiatives, visions of possible use. I already talked about putting... one of the things that the church is considering doing is creating ward and stake web templates that allow you to have a real simple, standardized website that... and only allow access to people who have certain cookies on their computer that mean that they live in the local area. Okay. I'm the Napster generation. I'm entitled to everything. I'm entitled to whatever I want to know. But and there are people who are like that, right? And I actually am sort of one of them. But I said it to Lisa, who said, "Look, 2 months ago, my dad's feeling homesick for his old mission in Brazil, and I go find him all this stuff about the church in Brazil, and he's reconnected with it." Okay, and I could do that with South Africa. We could all do that. And we're thinking of making visits someplace, and we want to connect with people who we care about around the world. Anyway, unofficially we can have a greater dissemination of high-quality religious content. What I want to say is encourage local unit websites to display interesting local content. Former missionaries can reconnect. Visitors can learn about local meeting times, plans, and activities. Potential move-ins can get a sense of the local church. We can put decent sacrament meeting talks out there. We could put book reviews of books worth reading out there. We could finally get Sunstone up on the web. I understand that's going to happen one of these days. Is there anything we can do to encourage the church to embrace the possibility of people learning things? I'm sorry, but Brigham Young.
Answer that question. Don't you want to answer that question?
Okay, so. Yeah, I mean Brigham Young said, we've got it on tape, right? encourage the young people of the church to explore all the different religions and compare them to Mormonism, he used the word, and when they compare them, they will see that ours is a true religion. Okay, there's that kind of faith in church members. It must have been hard for God to send us down here, right? We were going to be out of control. The world was going to be out of control. There was all kinds of information available. And he didn't censor it. He didn't tell it. I mean, our theology has the right answer to this written question written all over it. Okay? But you know, there's organizational people. And there's PR. And Jesus didn't have a logo. Anyway, please give me a tiny bit of feedback. What I hope you will do, I wrote my email address on all these handouts. And if we don't have time to cover stuff and you want to suggest ideas, please send them to me, and we'll work on some of this stuff together, and we'll talk about it in cyberspace. David.
I just related one anecdote, something along the line of the concerns that you have here. Just before Christmas time, we've always liked to go over to the Oakland Temple, particularly now that I live over there, to have some nice, often like Messiah.
Right, right.
Come on, Messiah, I like participating in. And so I wanted to find out, you know, what dates, what time. I thought, well, obvious, okay, so I did the obvious thing, went onto the web at OaklandTemple.org.
there it was. Couldn't find it.
And so I did a web, you know, web search, or maybe it's named something else. Couldn't come up with anything. And so I finally did some checking, and I went to a site that I've used to preserve my own personal DavidHBailey.com website, and the OpenTemple.org has not been reserved. It's not even
amazing.
Not really one. So I immediately told a neighbor of mine that used to be until recently was in the Open Temple presidency, and he just says, "Oh, well, you know, we don't do that kind of thing." But this is before this recent.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And to me, that's just inexplicable. You know, the church, they should make that's a tremendous missionary tool. They should make all of those, the temples and everything else, be very visible for visitors. Say,
right.
Yes, these are the visiting hours. Here's the tour. Here's a link to the church's Salt Lake website, if you wish. Here's some musical performances and other activities. Here's their schedule. Local missionaries.
How to contact?
Yeah, here's how you contact the missionaries. Yeah. I mean, and not only has that not been done, the website
wasn't reserved.
Has even been reserved. I take this for a member of the other temples.
Amazing.
It's an open temple. It's called templehill.com.
It's an unofficial
independent.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think even that, there's pressure on
him. Sometimes that's even going out on.
Yeah.
Pardon? Give out that number. Oh, God, I didn't bring it. A very important thing. There's a phone number you can call for clarification on this policy about a local website, and you can sort of give feedback and stuff like that. And what they told me is, you know, write to us and we'll get your opinions to the First Presbytery. Okay, there's something I hesitate to say because it sounds horrible, and it is horrible. But the people who made this decision, they did no research on how the web was being used, what was on the website. They got a couple complaints about a couple things, just like they almost abolished all single adult wards because four 40-year-olds were hitting on 23-year-olds. They got a few complaints about a few things and maybe one lawsuit. We're not clear about that. And they just shut everything down. And the reaction was, the honest feeling, I mean, there's two things to say. The people who made that decision had the impression, had the belief that there were probably 5 or 6 actually useful websites out of those 6,000. And that the way we'd find out if they were useful and valuable was by how loud people screamed when they went away.
Yeah.
Okay. That's true, okay? And you know, we're in a church where Elder Packer says, if you give us advice, you are steadying the ark. In other words, you deserve to be struck dead by God. So I'm not clear how much feedback they're likely to get. And so people who actually have feelings need to at least get them to somebody who will get them to them, because I will. I'm a seminary teacher. I'm expecting, you know, but I have some channels, and I actually have some people who have agreed to help with this. There is no correlation. Okay, let me read one summary hope. It is possible that this new medium, being so inexpensive and so uncensored, can make available to a much wider range of church members the intellectual and spiritual contributions of the best thinkers and feelers in the church. I want to know how this can be facilitated and if it's happening at all. Can we foresee the day when the Lowell Banyans and the David Wrights among us will be too well known and loved to be hushed, or where their voices are so much a part of our lives that attempts to suppress them will be simply irrelevant? Okay. Thank you all for your contributions. So anyway, this should be an ongoing discussion, and I'll try to create something like that somehow. If you send me, write in, okay?